At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer. Inside the evidence, behind the headlines, from someone who's been there. Here now, Jennifer Coffendaffer.
True crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host, I'm Jen Coffendaffer. This is going to be one of those episodes that it's just difficult. It's really, when I was preparing for this, and we have a wonderful guest joining us, couldn't be more apropos for this case to discuss it, but it just makes me sick. I want to throw up right now just a quick picture as I do the most briefest rundown of this case and put Emmanuel up on the screen. This is the case of Emmanuel Haro. Now, Emmanuel Haro, back on August 14th of this year, so not very long ago, you might remember that harrowing account of her baby being kidnapped as she changed the diaper. This was Rebecca Haro. She was in a retail parking lot. She reported in San Bernardino County, actually, and that will come into play later, but essentially saying she was whacked in the face and her baby was stolen, and kind of an exact Susan Smith almost parody of this supposed situation. And then Jake Haro, Emmanuel's father and her husband, he gets on with the same sort of plea. So that was on August 14th. For those of you who don't know, Rebecca is 41 and Jake is 32. There's been a lot made of this relationship and whether she could have been coerced and so forth into this situation. We're going to talk a lot about this. But essentially, after that attack on August 15th, law enforcement says, look, listen, we're looking for him. The parents get back on several media outlets and again, you know, make this plea on August 18th. There are searches that happen, particularly search warrants that were served at the Haro's home. This was very important. Whenever you see something like this, you know there's a change in the investigation. Also, they talk about, of course, reviewing surveillance information. By August 19th, there's an attorney. I should say within 24 hours, law enforcement reported that there were inconsistencies in the statement, and they were having all sorts of issues with that. Really saying that, listen, we can't rule out foul play. And that was very early, literally the day after the report first came in. By August 19th, Jake already had an attorney. August 22nd, Jake and Rebecca were arrested. And August 24th, more searches. August 27th, August 26th was their first hearing. It was really brief, and essentially $1 million bail was set. August 27th was that huge press conference. We're going to talk about that. And then essentially September 4th was their last court appearance just yesterday where it was an arraignment. And of course, they both pled not guilty. September 17th, for those of you writing down dates, that's the date of their preliminary hearing. And we're going to get into that. But without further ado, I want to bring to the stage Philip Dubé. He is one of my favorite guests, a friend of the show. And the reason I love having him on, and I've talked about this before, is he served in Los Angeles, so he's very familiar with California law. He is very familiar and knows all about this case. I'm going to hit him up with a lot of questions I know you all are probably wanting to ask as well, hopefully. I'm going to chat very closely today. And Philip served both as a prosecutor and he was a career a defense attorney, a public defender, which is the exact office, meaning a public defender's office, that are representing both Rebecca and Jake Harrow in this case. So without further ado, bringing you up on the stage here, my friend. How are you?
Good. Happy Friday. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. I wanted to do that quick rundown because even though it's only been about a week, well, I guess two weeks now, there's a lot that's happened, and it happened lightning fast. I'm so proud of my fellow law enforcement officers. I want to get right into this, though, Philip. First of all, I want to ask you, when there are two different jurisdictions, remember, initially involved, San Bernardino County, and then really they believe venue because the crime was committed in Riverside County. We have a Riverside prosecutor. We have a lead detective out of San Bernardino. What, as a DA, what does that pose for the DA? Any issues with that?
Well, legally, prosecutors have to prove the county where a crime was committed in order to convict. And if you don't have the proper venue, the defense can attack that by motion and get it dismissed. Truthfully, I mean, I've had to do it over the years. If they are in the wrong forum, there is no jurisdiction to even hear the case. Now, it doesn't mean that the defendants walk. It just means that they're going to be held for a lengthier period of time until they get the case properly filed. And in a situation like this, it is not uncommon where a crime is purportedly committed at or near a boundary line to sister counties. Sometimes it's really difficult to determine who has jurisdiction. But in the end, it really doesn't matter because Jake Harrow is on formal felony probation out of Riverside County. So they can just go in and pick him up, frankly, without a warrant, just on an alleged probation violation and hold him in the county jail until he gets on calendar in court. And then it'll buy the prosecution and law enforcement more time to try to figure out where, if anywhere, the baby died.
You know, this is the perfect segue because I want to talk about his first daughter, his daughter, Carolina. And Carolina, as you may know, was viciously attacked. I went into this in great detail on Twitter, multiple bones broken, head trauma, a brain bleed, absolutely viciously suffered abuse for a long period of time and is currently bedridden, obviously severe brain damage. Let's talk about how in the hell this judge, and I want to put him up on the stage, but I guess I have to remove this first, how this judge could have ever decided to give probation. This is Dwight D. Moore. Probation to such an offender?
Well, let's be clear. Did the prosecution make the offer? Typically, whenever a defendant pleads out before a judge, it means that a settlement offer has been extended to a defendant. And you can bet that if he had a public defender or any private attorney who was worth their salt, they're going to sit the client down and say, grab it. You need to take this because some of these counts could carry significant amount of time in prison. Now, having said that, even if the prosecution offers it, the court does not have to accept the plea. If the court is not aware of all the violence and all the underlying horrific facts giving rise to the charges and just go ahead and rubber stamps the plea and enters the conviction, then yeah, shame on the court for accepting the plea without having all the relevant facts. But to be perfectly candid with you, Jennifer, if we had to stop every plea, every case, particularly in LA County, just so a judge can go behind the record, learn the facts of all the cases, and basically interfere with the negotiations of defense attorneys and prosecutors, I'm telling you, the California judiciary would come to a screeching halt. You would never be able to, as we say in the biz, keep the meat moving. You got to keep it moving. I hate to say it, you know? But in the more serious cases where a prosecutor might be objecting to a plea deal, courts can entertain what's called an open plea. Sometimes we call it a blind plea, where you put it up to the court. You give the court all the relevant information, including a defendant's record, their probation report. They can even read the police report, and the court can fashion what they feel is an appropriate sentence. In this particular case, he was given a formal grant of probation. But I have reason to believe that the reason why he got such a, what we perceive to be a sweet deal, is because by the time the case made it to the bench for a plea, the case had aged quite a bit. And I just have a feeling that either he had already served a substantial amount of time, or he maybe had been in and out of a state hospital due to mental competency issues and needed treatment rather than prison. Just a guess. I haven't seen all the court documents. But otherwise, I don't know how you can justify this type of disposition, because as you know, oftentimes criminal defendants don't change. They just get older. And to think that a child abuser, a willful child abuser with this type of aggravated abuse could get, I don't want to call it a slap on the wrist, but basically a lenient sentence. It kind of, I don't know if I want to say gives him permission, but it almost invites recidivism for the same crime, unless you have some type of tried and true record that he has been successfully treated. Or that maybe it was just an isolated incident and there is no reason to believe it would ever recur.
Well, you ready for this, Philip? Because this crime occurred in 2018, where this child was, and I have all these pictures and I'll put them up a little bit later because this only allows me to do a set number of pictures. But this little girl was beat mercilessly numerous different times. Her bones were at various stages of healing in 2018. Now,
and she was 10 weeks old. How old was that child?
10 weeks old. Yeah. 10 weeks old. I just saw a little 10-week-old baby. And of course, I've had three children myself. It's hard to describe for people who maybe haven't been around a 10-week-old. They're literally like this big.
Yeah.
They're little teeny little fingers. They are so precious. And all they need is love. It's so amazing. Like if you just hold them and cuddle them, they don't even cry. They only cry if they're hungry or they're cold. Mm-hmm. And even when they're tired, they just fall asleep. But all of that aside, 2018, he wasn't charged until 2021. He was free. No mental issues, not in an asylum, not in any place. So he's just roaming around free. 2023, Philip, is how long it took for this case to be adjudicated in June. And I'll tell you what, the prosecutor wasn't involved in any sort of plea bargain. What happened was exactly what you described, the ladder, where his defense counsel went before the judge and they said, listen, we're going to plead to all the charges, because the only thing that apparently had been charged is this child cruelty instead of, how about attempted murder? And so that is what happened. He got probation, if you will. He actually had to do some community service type situation. Philip, this judge who was a visiting judge, how in the world are they not held accountable? Please tell our audience, because so many of us are so upset with so many judges right now passing down these ridiculous sentences.
Particularly in the state of California, the bench has judicial independence. meaning they are not to be swayed or influenced by public outcry, certainly by the pressures of being voted off the bench, by media, press accounts, and people screaming and yelling in open court. They are supposed to independently look at the record, look at the evidence, and fashion basically a settlement disposition that they feel is fair and appropriate under the circumstances. And as you well know, Jennifer, that is a very subjective type analysis. You know, you take a judge from a neighboring county and give them the same facts and the same record, he would have gone to prison. And frankly, it could have been for an indefinite duration. But you just never know what the predisposition or the predilections of a sitting judge may be. But it would seem to me that the defense attorney kind of had a pulse, if you will, on this particular judge and figured, you know, it couldn't hurt. Let's just plead him out now, settle early on. And statistically and historically, you get the better deals, the best deals, the earlier you settle in the proceedings. So they played that card right. I hate to say it. Now, if this judge is getting too much outcry, California has what's called the disqualification provisions, meaning that DAs can, we call it paper a judge, disqualify the judge, where you just fill out a form in every case and just say, we believe this judge is prejudiced against the prosecution. You don't even have to explain yourself. You don't even have to state the reasons why. You just file it and the case gets moved to a different judge. And that's it. And if a judge gets too many of these affidavits or papers, they have to move that judge to a court where other judges in the building don't have to pick up the slack. Because in the final analysis, everything that that judge is getting papered on or removed from has to go to fellow judges in the building, and they don't want to have to pick up the slack. In the end, it's work for them. It's work for his colleagues, and it will catch up, and eventually he'll be moved out maybe into a traffic court or into small claims court.
Well, I will say this. He retired, believe it or not, back in 2021. So he was already retired, but he is one of these judges, and I know you probably are familiar with this, that sort of rotates around and fills in for other judges. Can you talk about that process? And have you ever had issues with judges that are like substitute teachers that are filling in for the casework that drop the ball like this happened?
In the state of California, a judge is fully vested for retirement and full pension, I believe, after 20 years. They are partially vested after 7 years. And if they had a legal career prior to that as an attorney, and they have other independent income or wealth from their work in the legal profession prior to being elevated to the bench, they then have multiple sources of income. So what'll happen is at the 20-year mark, most judges step down. And they collect two pensions, maybe one from civil service as a public defender or a DA, or if they were in private practice, they socked away money for later. And then as a judge, they get a full pension. But at the end of that 20-year mark, they can be invited back for a limited number of days. I think it's 120 days a year. Don't quote me on that. To serve at the leisure of a presiding judge on assignment on a fill-in basis. So for example, if you have a judge who's out on medical leave or extended vacation, or maybe there's just a shortage of bench officers in the county or in a given courthouse, they can bring a retiree in on assignment for limited duration, but they still have all full powers of a regular sitting judge. The only difference is that they're basically semi-retired.
Well, I tell you what, I do appreciate you explaining to everybody sort of how this process works, but I'm seeing a guy that either A, didn't do his homework, or B, did his homework and was completely incompetent in his assessment. Something he said to Jay Caro was basically, I'm giving you, and I'm paraphrasing, a second chance. This is going to be held over your head, this suspended sentence. So basically, keep it clean. How can a judge with 20 years on the bench in California not understand what you opened up the show with, which was basically a child abuser is a child abuser is a child abuser. They only get better at it. This has been my experience. They beat and they beat and they beat, and they do a better job of hiding it and getting somebody sometimes beat to the point just before death, but they don't change unless they receive some sort of counseling, and then it's very unusual.
Over time, many judges kind of soften and they become impervious to a lot of the violent fact patterns that we see in criminal cases. And at some point, they feel that if somebody really wants to plead out, if somebody really wants to take responsibility, and there doesn't appear to be any objection from the other side, and there are treatment modalities ready in place for the defendant, a lot of judges will take a chance. Because if you really think about it, Jennifer, probation is sort of a leash. If you violate any of the terms of probation, meaning you don't show up to probation and check in as ordered, because remember, you're being supervised and they set dates for you to go in, meet with your probation officer, or maybe even call in. You have to show that you're paying your restitution. You have to show that you're doing your community service. And certainly you cannot reoffend. If you commit more crimes, they're going to revoke probation, set it for a hearing, and you don't get a jury on a hearing for a probation violation. When your probation is revoked and you get a hearing, the judge hears the evidence. And God help you if you're found in violation and probation is terminated, because it means the only place you're going is prison. So it sounds like now he has violated, and he violated by with a real doozy, because now we have another, well, a missing baby at any rate, and certainly by all appearances, an abused baby. But make no mistake about it, at a minimum, he will do time for the probation violations, even if he is acquitted of the murder.
Well, thank God, because this guy should never be out. I wanted to follow up with the fact that Carolina now, I believe her name has been changed to Promise. She's been adopted. She's in a relative, I think it's her cousin's home now. And you know, by the grace of God, you know, she has somebody to love and care for her. But I just am always perplexed, and I want to get your word or your opinion on this, as to the severe abuse that children seem to receive over and over again. And the paths that so many of these judges, and we go through cases every month, if not every week, of this sort of thing happening. Have you ever heard of a judge being sanctioned for letting somebody out, even whether it's a child or not, for committing a terrible crime, and they get out and they commit another terrible crime such as this?
Never. No. And in fact, at least in the state of California, it is not a disciplinable charge if the public, or if what we call the Commission on Judicial Performance, objects to a court's ruling. They have wide discretion to sentence a defendant as they deem appropriate under the law. As long as they are following the law and they're allowing both sides to be heard, if you don't like a judge's rulings, your remedies are not to remove the judge through the discipline process or to sanction them. It's to go to the ballot box and get them voted off, or you paper them, we call it, meaning you file that affidavit and you don't appear in front of them. And by the way, if the judge did not take the plea initially at the time of the grant of probation, you can still paper a judge on a violation hearing. So all that really matters is that the judge has not already decided a disputed or contested issue of fact or law. If a judge has already decided one of those issues on a case, then you've waived your ability to paper the judge. But if it is a first appearance by the judge, and it's just what I call a bumping grind or housekeeping type proceeding where you're just setting a date or you're asking for a continuance, but you're not really engaging in full-on disputed litigation, you can affidavit or paper that judge and get it sent to another court. As a practical matter, defense attorneys are not going to paper this judge because he obviously, I don't want to say is soft on crime, but if past is prologue, if you will, then we can pretty much use that as a metric in understanding how he'll rule in future cases. It would really be on the DA's office to get him off the bench or paper him out of existence.
Wow. Well, I probably beat a dead horse here, but I got to be honest. I mean, it's enraging to see a judge let this kind of abuse happen. But let's move on to baby Emmanuel. So at this point, both of his parents have been charged with murder, and they're on $1 million bond. Today, they pled not guilty. But the interesting piece of this case, in my opinion, is the cooperation by Jake Harrow. Now, Jake Harrow took investigators to a field, if you will, in sort of a foothill area. And they spent, meaning he and investigators, spent hours out there searching. That took place on August 22nd. So only a few days, really 6 days after the reported event. When I saw that, when I saw him out there in his orange jumpsuit, and I want you to go ahead and talk about this process. A lot of people think, oh yeah, you just go in and you get him out of jail. It's no big deal. But it is a big deal, and you have to sign your life away as a law enforcement officer. But tell us from the prosecution standpoint, what do you do when that agent or that officer comes in and says, listen, I want to pull this guy out to help us find a body?
I don't think that's what happened here. I don't believe for one minute that law enforcement went to DAs, because nothing had been filed yet in court. The case wasn't even assigned. There was no filing deputy district attorney even assigned to the case. It's still in the investigatory stage, meaning DAs rely on cops to bring them a completed file, and they review that file to see if they can bring charges that can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. At that point, if they feel the evidence is insufficient, they give the file back to the cops, tell them to beat the bushes and go back and bring more evidence. So, but let me tell you what I think happened. This is just based on my years of doing this stuff. I think that they did one of two things. They have what's called a crime scene reconstruction investigative technique, where during the interrogation process, they kind of play good cop, bad cop, and try to give a suspect the opportunity to tell their version of events, even if the suspect believes that it is exculpatory and it will tend to exonerate them. And they even give them the opportunity, after they've spilled it, if you will, to go out to the area where the body may have been dumped. And they give them that opportunity, but it's not necessarily in their mind for purposes of garnering more evidence and recovering the baby, but it's validating their version, their story. That's one way. The other way is, and I think this is what happened in this case, they didn't use the crime scene sort of reconstruction, investigatory manipulative technique. I think instead they set up a Perkins operation, meaning they picked him up, they put him in a jail cell and gave him an undercover cellmate in league with law enforcement. So formed an alliance with the cops, maybe for their own deal, or maybe they're in fact a cop undercover. This is pre-filing of charges in court. This is all pre-arraignment in court. And if this cellmate is posing as a fellow inmate, fellow defendant, it is not deemed to be an overbearing, coercive environment, even though he's locked up, for purposes of the Miranda doctrine, meaning that if you say something to an undercover, even if it's being recorded, unbeknownst to the suspect, it doesn't violate the Miranda doctrine. It just does not. So what I think probably happened, he had a cellmate posing as a fellow suspect in unrelated charges and said, so what are you in for? What's going on? You know, and they start first talking, you know, a bunch of small talk about their lives, about their lady friends, their children, what kind of work they do. And then once they cozy up to one another enough, they start talking about the crimes that are holding them. And I just have a feeling that he spilled it to the inmate. And I think it was reported that he claims to have been sleeping with mom and the baby in the bed together as part of this bonding process. and he's a heavy set, sort of stout guy. And in the middle of the night, he kind of rolled over onto the baby and the baby smothered. And when you have that type of hypoxia or anoxia on such a young baby, the baby is going to asphyxiate. And his version was, I believe, to the informant, that the baby suffocated. They both panicked. They didn't know what to do. So they disposed of the body off the side of the freeway somewhere in Riverside County. And that cellmate was either wired with some type of Fargo wire or some type of bugging device, or maybe the entire cell was being eavesdropped on, that law enforcement was listening in on it. And after they got the goods, they then pulled him out to talk to him more. And after that, they took him out to the field. They took him out to that very field to see if they can get a visceral reaction from him, to see if he could lead them to the baby and get off his chest what on earth happened, tell his version of events. And unfortunately, you know, he got arrested and he's brought in. And that Perkins operation, sort of, I don't necessarily want to call it a confession, because there is a difference in law between a confession and incriminating admissions, landed him in the arraignment court. A confession, just for viewers, is where you admit all elements of a crime, all the facts and circumstances where you and essentially acknowledge commission of the crime. An incriminating admission, or just a statement, means that you are partially acknowledging a crime. But they felt that based on whatever he said during that Perkins operation, during that whole recorded operation, was enough to hold him and charge him. And how do we know they were correct? Because the DA filed. And now this is the posture of the case. They are both charged with murder. Now, I have a whole other conversation about Rebecca, unlike Jake, we'll get into that later, but I think that's going to be a different burden for the prosecution.
All right. We have a lot to unpack here, a lot to unpack with everything you said. And obviously for our audience, when Philip comes on, this isn't pre-planned in terms of, we don't have a script. I don't pre-interview Philip. We talk very raw because both of us have done this job, and we can take a set of facts and look at it and talk about it. And so I want to break down a couple of things you said. We know, first of all, that Jake and Rebecca were arrested on August 22nd.
Correct.
Okay. So they were arrested, and I have those arrest photos somewhere. They were arrested, and it was after their arrest that then this search began, at least with Jake. Mm-hmm. Your contention is that from the 15th, which was really when law enforcement first, in my opinion, believed there was issues, and then they conducted those search warrants. So they were investigatively focused on the parents, that this was part of, if you will, the setup. Because I also want to talk about, we never called it Perkins operations in the FBI. That wasn't, and I know why it's called Perkins operation. It's that Supreme Court case, which it's fine if you want to talk about it. And I know it's more of a California. I called some of my colleagues. I'm like, why are they calling this a Perkins? And they said, oh, Jen, don't worry. It's what we call it in California. It's not called that in other parts of the United States, certainly not in the federal system. But nevertheless, it doesn't matter because we're all talking about the same thing. And that means for this to go off correctly, at least the ones I've been involved with, and I've never done one with a law enforcement officer in, only with other inmates, because it's very critical that everybody thinks the person in there is legit.
Yes.
No one can know, but literally the warden, what's going on typically, maybe the assistant warden. In the cases we were in, we just spoke with the warden and we made everything happen. So the booking people don't know, the jailers don't know. Everyone thinks that that person. So in law enforcement, if you're going to do that, and it's a truly an agent, you have to what we call backstop them, meaning you have to have them appropriately backstop, because just like on Twitter and in social media, you have slews in that jail facility. You have trustees, you have people that can look at people's files, and you wouldn't believe it's like a bunch of sewing circle women in there. That's the reality. You have all these people talking and gossiping. Literally, it's just like X. So you can't just like throw somebody in there. You can't just say, okay, we're just going to put a cop in there. That will never work. He has to be totally backstopped as having a criminal record. He has to be booked in and everything. So for a Perkins operation to work correctly, they would have had to have been planning this maybe days, many days earlier, have that guy in there so that on the 22nd, when they did the arrest, because the arrest came first, if this Perkins operation took place, and it's been reported by Brian Inton as a source, he says that this is what happened. He doesn't give these details. I don't even know if he knows these details per se. But he basically is saying what you're saying, that after the arrest, so they're sitting in there on charges. He had probation. She was already booked on false reporting. That, according to Brian Inton, he says that they ran people in on both of them. So now you have to have two backstopped, unless they ended up using inmates, which is really dicey to do in a case like this on such short notice, that would have been in there. And then according to Inton, there's two different reports. One is the one you talked about, like rolled over and smashed. That, my understanding, was what he told law enforcement. But then according to Inton, he says they killed him and threw him in the trash, not in that field. Threw him in the trash. Then law enforcement, I don't know if you saw the press release, they came up and they said there absolutely was no jailhouse informant confession. So I'm really confused on this case. We're going to find out in discovery, because you have to disclose a Perkins operation. Talk to us about, why would law enforcement, if this Perkins operation happened, this, let me tell you, if you didn't see this, Philip, this DA was angry when they asked about what had been reported. He said that absolutely did not happen. There's been no jailhouse confession. Brian Inton came back and said, listen, they can say that. I'm standing by my reporting. Tell us what you think. Do you think as a DA you would ever say that if it didn't happen or happened?
I think it's a matter of legal semantics. A jailhouse confession means that law enforcement has pulled a suspect into an interrogation room, read them their Miranda rights, and interrogated them, questioned them. And rather than waive their right to remain silent and or waive their right to have counsel present, they talked. They sang like a bird. That's called a confession. If you basically admit that you committed all elements of a crime, that is a jailhouse confession. Typically, confessions are not done out in the field. They're not done in your home. They're not done in the backseat of a car or in a lunchroom of a business. They bring you down to the station because it's a more controlled environment, where maybe in the light fixture or the ductwork or the vents in the ceiling, they have HD quality cameras and lenses rolling, and they can record everything in real time and have it as evidence. Otherwise, if they don't have that corroborating evidence, then all you really have is a cop's word that a suspect confessed. I have a feeling that what the elected DA said to the press, which was accurate, that there was no confession in the legal sense in an interrogation room, but there was one in what we call the Perkins operation sense. And by the way, it comes from a case called Perkins versus Illinois from 1990. And I'll just tell you briefly what the backstory is. In Perkins, a guy was in custody on a battery charge, just aggravated battery, I think, somewhere in Illinois. I think it was East St. Louis, so over the border from Missouri, and he was doing time. And another inmate reported that they thought Perkins may have been involved in an unrelated murder. So what do? They put an inmate undercover in Mr. Perkins' jail cell to kind of, you know, chum up to him, cozy up to him, and talk about life, talk about their favorite food, talk about their favorite music. And then they start talking about crimes. And they start boasting, have you ever committed a real big crime? And he says, yeah. He goes, you know, I did a murder and I got away with it. And unbeknownst to Mr. Perkins, all of this is being taken in by that plant. So, of course, after that sort of colloquy and that entire operation was done, they yanked Mr. Perkins out of his cell, brought him into court, and arraigned him on murder charges. And at issue in the Perkins case was the constitutionality of that entire Perkins recording operation. And the court found it did not violate the Miranda Doctrine. Plain and simple. There was no coercive aspect or deceitful aspect on the part of law enforcement. And the court found that it was completely lawful and constitutional. And you can use this type of deceit and trickery to gather evidence against a suspect, and they upheld it. And that has been the law of the land ever since. And that was in 1990. So that was over 30 years ago. And it's very possible, I don't know what year you went on board with the FBI, that they were not calling it a Perkins operation quite yet, that maybe they had other names for it that they were using under applicable state law or in the Ninth Circuit or whatever circuit court of appeals you were in the United States.
That's interesting. I came on in 1990 with the FBI. And again, you know, federally, we just didn't call it that. But like you said, maybe it just took a while for it to percolate and people to use. But according to my colleagues in California, they said that that's what they call it in California. Also, it's not exactly widely used. I researched, I think over 6 years, I found 50 operations in all of California. That's not that many, because again, and I think this is important to note, is it's difficult. It's not what people think. Oh, yeah, we're just going to dress up this agent or this person and just send them in. And then you have to be able to trust, if you're going to use a fellow inmate, that they're not going to give up the ghost. Exactly. You know, that they're going to go on a piece or on a napkin and say, I'm an informant. You know, it's really dicey to have these things be successful, in my opinion. But I think I really appreciate what you said, because I think that now this is making, from an investigative standpoint, more sense how they did this. This would have, assuming this happened, this was pre-planned back days and days earlier to get either an informant in or a undercover officer in, to have them planted in there. So they were already there when Jake came in after his arrest on the 22nd. He makes these exclamations, if you will, whether it's the rolled over scenario. That's the problem with the rumor mill, right? You know, we've heard two different reports, but it's all.
I personally believe it was a Perkins. And I'm going to tell you why. One of the reasons is when they brought him into court for the arraignment, he was sitting there on camera. You could see his profile. He was clenching his teeth. He was so angry because he knew that what he had done in his jail cell by spilling the beans to his cellmate was what landed him now in court on a murder charge. It was his own mouth. And he was probably pissed off at himself. He could kick himself that he was the one who, in fact, landed himself in court and not at the fault of anybody else. Had he have kept his mouth shut, not said a word to the cops and not said a word to the Perkins plant, I'm not sure if there would have been enough to arrest him, at least on a murder charge, maybe on a probation violation. They can get him on that for something, for maybe what we call an internal violation, meaning not because he committed a new crime, but, you know, did you report every month to your probation officer? If not, we're going to hold you on a violation. Did you do the hours of community service you were ordered to do? If not, we're going to hold you on that violation. Any little thing could land you before a judge without a jury on a probation violation where the standard of proof for the violation is preponderance of the evidence, namely more likely than not that you violated probation, as opposed to proof beyond a reasonable doubt that you violated probation. And I'm telling you, by looking at his jowls and his jaw, if he could just kick himself and want to punch somebody, he can only blame himself.
You know, I've got that picture. I screenshotted it and I want to put that up, but I have to take some stuff down to get it back up. So I'm going to pose another question while I get off and do that.
Okay.
My question for you is, and I agree now when I think of how they did this, I really, my hats are off to them. But I do find it interesting how the DA was so adamant. And I understand syntax and, you know, maybe he was just so angry, like what happened in Brian Koberger, right? So angry that there's a source. I mean, we know that in Brian Koberger case, there's a full on investigation as to who spilled the beans on a lot of that information, right? There's an investigation. They have investigators. They've got a special group looking to try to figure out who gave that information to Dateline. And I think even though that case has been resolved and adjudicated and he didn't appeal, it doesn't matter. They're going to want to know who the leak was. And I'm sure it's going to take them a bit to figure it out. But back to this case.
By the way, I don't think they will. Just so you know, if you violate a court order where evidence was under a protective order or a gag order, if you will, it's only a misdemeanor. That's the worst case scenario. I really doubt that law enforcement officials are going to utilize all the efforts of their law enforcement team to get to the bottom of a misdemeanor. I think they're going to let it go. I do. Now, whether or not each law enforcement department wants to do its own disciplinary investigation, that's another question. But I think the court is going to let go of a special prosecutor to investigate a leak that's only a misdemeanor, even if proven.
Yeah, you might be right. All I know is, and I'm sure you watch it too, Judge Hippler was PO'd.
Yes.
And this was not a negotiable situation, at least what I saw. We saw the written order. There was a written order. I haven't seen it rescinded, but I have to be honest, I didn't go on to look and see if he has rescinded that order. So I'm operating under the belief that his ire combined with his order, that it's still going. But I totally see your point of view. And I was reading that too. I was looking up and I thought, my gosh, even if they find it, it's a misdemeanor.
It's not a big deal, really. And now that the case is over, the case is settled, if you think about it, what's the prejudice? You haven't tainted any future jury pools. It's not as if now evidence has to be redacted in any. The case is over. So in a way, I hate to say it, the leak may have mooted it all out, you know? So, or the plea may have mooted it all out.
The plea mooted out this. Except for, Philip, how about when it comes to future cases? I just think I could see, and I agree, if the judge rescinds that, I still think that local law enforcement, Moscow, maybe they're so small, but Moscow, state police, and I could tell you the FBI is going to make sure and vet that out. I really don't think it's an FBI agent. I just don't think that they're going to risk all that. It's would be very shocking. But local and state are just not paid and compensated enough, and it's such a different process. Although Kash Patel may be changing that, but nevertheless,
by the way, it really could have been nobody's fault. Remember what happened in Delphi, Jennifer, when Richard Allen was awaiting trial? His defense team had all the gory sort of, carnography, I call it, which is the gory autopsy and crime scene photos, laid out on a conference table in their office. And they had a guest in there who basically surreptitiously seized a lot of it or made copies of it and leaked it. Now, it's not to say that the defense attorneys are completely off the hook, but they did not willfully and maliciously do it. it was sort of done in a clandestine fashion. And I think to take disciplinary action or criminal action against those attorneys, I think would just be a little going a bit too far, I think. And seriously, and if all you have now in this situation is a potential misdemeanor hanging over the leaker's head, I think the judge has to let it go. The case is over. And if any law enforcement department that employed that peace officer or employee wants to take action, let them. You never know. Maybe they have rights under civil service where they wouldn't necessarily be out of a job, but maybe they'll get suspended without pay for 3 to 5 days, where the penalty for the violation would be kind of lenient.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if that just completely percolates down or whether anything comes of it. But you bring up such great points. But back to this, obviously, there's a leak.
Yeah.
You know, obviously.
Yeah.
And so it's just kind of interesting. But I love the timeline, I think, that we've sort of set forth here that makes a lot of sense. But let me get you to a question. I want to bring those pictures up of both of the Haros in the courtroom. I want to talk about, first of all, really quickly, I think it's actually complete BS that he rolled over. That child, and I've been bringing up some pictures. Just look at these pictures really quick. Look at this, to me, much more healthy of a child. You know, his younger pictures. Look at this one. Oh. Oh, no, that's the wrong one. That's where things aren't going well. Look at this one.
Terrible.
Well, to me, this one, he looks much more healthy. And then as we move along, again, healthy, his eyes, he doesn't appear to be cross-eyed, at least somewhat attentive. But then, you know, as the time rolls on, and I have another picture too, several other pictures, where you can see the flaccidness, the staring. For those of us who have had little babies, you can tell there's something so very wrong.
Well, you know, if I were defending them, given the age of this baby, it's very possible, and I'm not saying that this is the case, that at birth, any evidence of maybe some type of a developmental disability was not immediately apparent. But as the child is sort of on track to thrive and prosper, is not doing so, it could mean that this baby is on the spectrum. And sometimes the symptoms of abuse are consistent with those of fetal alcohol syndrome, autism spectrum disorder, and sometimes even Asperger's syndrome. But without the opportunity to examine this baby by some type of neonatal doctor or obstetrician or maybe even gynecologist, we won't know. But you're right. If you don't have an expert look at that to make that determination, it looks like the baby was gradually beaten into looking like this. But there really could be a medically sound reason for how and why this child appears in these photos. And I don't think we have enough evidence to say that this was caused by the father or the mother or both in concert.
Well, that's what I want to get to for you to discuss legally. I pull up a few more photos that I think are relevant. If you could please discuss, because I think this could be the issue. And I think this is what happened back in 2018 with that horrible abuse against Carolina, which was her name back then. And the reason this took so long to develop, 2021 charge, 2023 pled. And I believe it was because of the finger pointing, right? What you always see happen. He did it. No, she did it. He did it. No, she did it. And so now you've got a huge problem, because who really was responsible for that horrible abuse of that child? And talk to us about the problem as a prosecutor, not as a defense attorney. I want your prosecutor hat on. How do you deal with that? They've both been charged with murder. Remember, we know there's blood at the scene. We know there were other children that maybe talked about the pervasive abuse, which is what they're saying Emmanuel died of.
I have a feeling, and this is just based on years of doing this stuff, and it's not in any way, shape, or form based on a body of evidence that's been collected in the case, that she was abused herself by him, and that she was probably battered into submission, into saying that the baby was kidnapped by some unknown assailant who basically came up to her and said, "Hola," cold cocked her, knocked her to the ground in the parking lot of the Big Five, and took that child. Okay, you and I can debate the merits of that. It doesn't sound all that credible, but that's her story. But let's just pretend that she's really just covering for him. It doesn't mean that she murdered the baby. And it certainly doesn't mean that she had aided and abetted the murder. At most, what you have is an accessory after the fact. And if that's the case, that is a violation of California Penal Code Section 32. And all it means is that you help facilitate the cleanup or the aftermath of the crime. The good news for Rebecca Harrow is that that tops out at 3 years. And you would only do half. So even if she went down on an accessory after the fact, I would absolutely defend her on that charge. The worst that could happen to her is 3 years at halftime. That's a tremendous victory. And if that is really the case, chances are the DAs would work out a deal with her where she's willing to plead to accessory for less time or maybe even for probation in exchange for testifying against Jake. I would sit her down and encourage her to grab it. Otherwise, in theory, she could be charged as an aider and abettor to murder, and it's not worth the risk of getting life when if you are in fact just a battered spouse who covered for the abuser.
All right. As you said, we can debate the merits of that. I totally agree that that is what the defense position is going to be.
Yeah.
I think it's nonsense from the standpoint of they lived in that little house. I'm sure you saw it. It was a hot mess in there. And to think that they didn't understand the goings on, or you don't understand when your child is getting beaten and the results of that, what that looks like, at least judging from Carolina's beating, right? If those types of things were happening to Emmanuel, I know what you're saying, Jennifer, how can you prove any of that? We don't have a body. But my point is, what did they find digitally? Did they find, these people don't seem that sophisticated to me. I could be wrong, but they don't seem like criminal masterminds, even coming up with that ludicrous story at the Big Five. What if they have communications with each other? What if that, you know, even if they erased them that have been forensically found, what about blood? What about the witnesses, their other kids, if they were forensically interviewed by child specialists and they talked about the beatings he took? What about other witnesses? Philip, they have to have something. They've charged her with murder.
I don't think that at the time of her arrest that they had gathered enough digital evidence to reach a conclusion as to probable cause. I think at most what they might have had is probable cause to get a warrant. But I sincerely doubt that during that real tight period that it was enough time to not only get the warrant signed, executed, get the records, and get all the data analyzed, that it was enough time to formulate sort of a murder type arrest based on that limited evidence. I just don't think it's enough there. I think instead what they're doing is they're bringing them in to buy time to get that evidence. Now, I don't think they have it as to her yet. I think instead what they're doing is they're doing it on an aider and abettor theory. If you buy his version to the informant, that he rolled on the baby, suffocated the baby, and she allowed that to happen, maybe didn't engage in any type of life-saving measures to call 911 to try to save the baby, and instead just help dispose of the baby, I think there is an argument to be made that it is a form of second-degree implied malice murder, where you engage in such a reckless act in deliberate disregard for human life of a baby. I could see a jury convicting, if that's the theory. But once more evidence starts coming in to show, no, there really are no communications or texts or emails or WhatsApp chats on her phone to show that she was sort of forming an alliance with Jake to cover this up and to kill the baby. It's just not there. So the bottom line is only time will tell. But I think as to him, they can hold him for an indefinite duration until they get enough evidence to really prove up the murder. But I think they have it now. I think the fact that he gave that statement is enough to get him on a murder. Because let's think about it. Who in their right mind, who is that height, that weight, that size, so well upholstered around the midsection, would put such a small infant in an adult bed where you are prone to rolling over, putting all that dead weight on such a small newborn infant, to think that nothing could happen to that child? That is a reckless act that could give rise to a second degree murder, even if you didn't intend to end the life. What it shows is just disregard for human life, regardless of an intent to want to end life. And a jury can convict on that. They'd feel bad, but they'd say to themselves, who in their right mind put such a small infant, this little bundle of joy, in a bed with two large, robust people where that baby could get hurt? This is why you put a baby in a crib. You don't put an infant that young between two grown adults merely to bond. That is ridiculous. So I could see a jury coming back on a second degree murder.
Sorry about that, Philip. I was looking for a couple of those photos. I hear what you're saying here, but also I think they're going to be looking at what kind of care did this child receive? Did this child was Emmanuel vaccinated? Did he go to appointments that you would have really, you know, almost monthly? I mean, you're there, you're doing checkups, you've got vaccinations to get for your child, wellness checks. Also, I'm very curious about money. I am very curious about, we know that Jake Harrow seemed to be a scammer when it came to workman's comp and other things. Was this about money? And another interesting thing, and I know you've seen this and I've seen this, parents who not only have children for the money, for the welfare checks, they also, in some instances, and these are the really heinous ones, disable their child so they get even more money. I'm just saying, I agree with you. There's a lot to unpack here. But tell me how that fits in if Rebecca was not caring for this child appropriately and doing those checks. Do you see those as just misdemeanors?
First of all, I would have a different opinion about it if the child were in foster care in their home. If this were a foster child where they're guaranteed a handsome sum of money every month to raise the child as an incentive for taking the child in. And by the way, typically infants get fast-tracked for adoption and they get medical until they reach the age of majority. That would be a conversation to say that money would be the enticement. But if you really think about it, Jennifer, having a baby is, frankly, it's more of a liability. I mean, you've raised kids, you know what it costs to have a child. I really doubt that there is a financial incentive to have a child the natural way, to think that you're just going to live off the dole and raise a healthy, wealthy, and wise baby. It's just that is counterintuitive, in my opinion, anyway. So what is it? What are you left with, really? If it's not really a financial motive, it sounds like that the guy's just a thug. You know, either he just gets off on beating little defenseless babies, or he sort of heedlessly has no problem with rolling over on one in the middle of the night. In either case, they're both criminal acts, and you're not going to be, taken off the hook merely because you didn't intend to kill the child. It's so reckless that a jury is going to impute malice to you, and you're not going to walk away from it, regardless of how much money is involved or not involved. The other thing I can tell you, too, is that particularly in the public defender world, our clients are indigent. And it is not uncommon for social workers from the Department of Children and Family Services to go out to homes on a welfare check call and see families living in poverty and in squalor. that just because you're living in poverty and squalor doesn't mean that it's a dangerous environment or a dangerous setting. We don't remove children from the home merely because the parents are not wealthy. They can still be loved, nurtured, taken care of, even though they're going to be given top ramen, cornflakes, oatmeal, and not high-end, you know, Erewhon Whole Foods baby formula, you know? So if that's how the system operated, we would become an elitist system where otherwise lower middle class and poor families would lose their children because of their wealth status. And that would be unfair. And I don't think the dependency courts are in the business of penalizing poor parents merely because they just don't have the wealth. It's one thing to be poor, and it's another to be able to provide with government cheese, with cheap cereal and cheap formula. As long as you're doing the basics, then it's not criminal. That's just how I see it.
Yeah, no, I think you bring up a very good point. And there's many people who don't have much means that are amazing parents.
Yes.
This is my point. That whole rolling over on him is ridiculous. Worst excuses I've ever seen, especially because we have the track record of Carolina.
Right.
This wasn't a roller over. This was a smash, throw. I mean,
intentional act. An intentional act. Yeah.
It's so amazing how the amazing isn't the right word. It's so disgusting what these people, how sadistic they are. And anyone who can harm a 10-week-old baby, murder or harm a 7-month-old baby, they have serious psychological sadistic issues. You've seen it. You worked in LA as a public defender and a prosecutor. This happens all the time. It's sick. Yeah. And I think that's what a Jay Caro is. As far as her, I'm really not buying it. She's 9 years older than him. She apparently, from reports, has before had restraining orders, not against him, but against others. So she knows the process. She's not a little 19-year-old, you know, caught up with an older man. She's the older woman. And I'm just saying from my side of it, and I know you have a great defensive hat, I have no doubt you could get Rebecca off, so I'm so glad you're not defending her. But this case, it just really, really upsets me, and I guess everybody can tell that, because we're talking about a baby.
Yes, it's just such a tragedy, you know? And I don't know what became of the mother. I think the mother's name was Vanessa Avina.
Yes.
And I think that was her name. And when the 10-week-old got injured. And by the way, in California, they always abbreviate child victims' names in court pleadings for privacy and confidentiality reasons. They don't want to divulge the full name. And by the way, even in domestic violence cases, they do that as well. So it's no wonder that they didn't divulge the full names of these people. But we won't really know until the case goes to preliminary hearing what the facts are.
And okay.
Yeah.
Two questions for you here.
Yeah.
First of all, back to Vanessa. I'm sorry, Vanessa and Jake's abuse of Carolina, who is now called
Prop. 7 or 8 years old now?
I think she's nine. It's going strictly from my memory. And
well, because if it happened in 2018, that would have been 7 years ago, right?
Right.
So at 10 weeks old.
So no, you're right.
Give or take, give or take.
Thank you for your math.
That's okay.
My question is, and I think I know the answer, but please tell us legally, is there anything they could do to up the charges, to up the penalties, to include penalties against Jake Caro for that crime against Carolina Promise?
I guess in theory, if they can show that this was an intentional, premeditated act of first-degree murder, they can seek the death penalty. They can absolutely seek capital punishment. And the question is, would they? I doubt it. Not in this particular case, particularly in light of the defense that they would put on to show, yes, he admits that he killed the baby, but it was an accident. He rolled on the baby. It wasn't intentional in the purposeful way that we understand intent, but that it was done recklessly through an act of what we call implied malice. So I doubt that this is going to be the test case in a baby murder case for capital punishment. I sincerely doubt it. Now, if he had a prior murder on his record, absolutely, because having a prior murder as a capital defendant in and of itself is a special circumstance to seek death.
Okay, wait a minute. I'm actually reverting back to Carolina, not talking about Emmanuel now.
I misunderstood. Go ahead.
No, it's my fault. I wasn't clear and I'm skipping around. But what can be done for that suspended sentence, which I don't think is very long anyway? What's the most he's facing there?
Well, first of all, was it a suspended sentence? I'm not sure if it was actually suspended. And for viewers, what that means is that judgment has in fact been entered with a stated period of incarceration, but it is suspended. It's sort of in abatement, if you will, pending a violation while on probation. If he violates probation with that time sort of in abeyance, the court can actually impose it and terminate probation, and off he goes to prison. But my guess is that if it is a suspended sentence with execution of judgment suspended, it could be anywhere from 8 to 12 years. That's a guess without seeing the filing.
Okay, and I was looking it up because I have that filing, and I'll read it to you when we have a couple more questions. That's interesting. So maybe 10 to 12 years, but I'll look at it and I'll show it to you. I'll read what it says because it's very brief.
And by the way, that can run consecutive to the murder. Judge doesn't have to run that concurrent. So you can stack it so that he never gets out.
So my other question here is, and hopefully he doesn't get a judge like the other judge. Sorry, I had to throw that in there. As far as this particular crime, we have a preliminary hearing set for September 17th, I think I said it was, September 17th. Mm-hmm. Why in the world wouldn't they indict prior to that so they can forego the preliminary hearing? It never makes any sense to me when some of these state courts don't indict. There's a situation right now going on with a lady named Nikki Salim McCain. And Tyler McCain is in this preliminary hearing process. They're like, why didn't they indict? Talk to us about that.
Well, first of all, I sincerely doubt that the preliminary hearing is going to go that soon. They're going to continue it. It's going to get put over. It is extremely rare in a murder that the prelim go within the statutory period. Now, by all rights, every criminal defendant has the right to a speedy preliminary hearing within 10 court days from arraignment in California. But counsel is going to need more time to prepare. And here's why. Initially, the public defender was appointed. Public defender declared a conflict as to Rebecca. That means substitute counsel coming in from the bar panel where they have conflict counsel is going to need time to prepare. You don't just hand a manila folder that's maybe an eighth of an inch thick in a homicide to a defense attorney and say, here's your file. Have a good time. Go for it. Let me know how it goes. No, you put it over so you can work up the case, do your own investigation, get your own experts, challenge their evidence. It's something that does not happen overnight in a murder. Now, in the less serious cases like a car chase, a dope case, a gun charge, yeah, you give me that file, I can do that prelim within the period. But in a murder, you need to work that case up because remember, the defendant's entitled to effective assistance of counsel, not somebody who's just going to phone it in. Now, as to the grand jury stuff, it is extraordinarily rare in California state court to proceed by way of grand jury. I think in my entire career, I've had 3 or 4 grand jury cases. They go the preliminary hearing route for a couple of reasons. Number one is cheaper, okay? And it tends to be quicker. And number three, when you do a preliminary hearing where both sides have an opportunity to not just cross-examine the witnesses, but present their own evidence, both sides can see really what they have. They can see how the case might unfold at trial, and they can put a value on it as to what they think it should settle for in lieu of a trial. Whereas if you just do the grand jury proceeding, first of all, you don't have a judge, number one. And number two, the defense is not even entitled to be there. You don't even get to cross-examine their witnesses, and you don't even get to put on a defense. It's just a one-sided proceeding that can be probably done maybe in less than a week in a case like this. So it's extraordinarily rare. But let's say hypothetically, while preliminary hearing is pending, you're before a judge who you think might be too light on crime and who you think might throw out a murder charge and only hold them on a manslaughter, then you might impanel a grand jury so that you get a superseding indictment over the criminal complaint in lieu of a preliminary hearing. But those are rare. And I sincerely doubt in today's age, with all eyes on this case, that any Riverside County Superior Court judge is gonna kick this murder. It's gonna go to a jury or it's gonna end up in a plea, but there is no way that a judge is gonna dismiss it. No way.
Well, it's so different, I will say, in the federal system, because in the federal system, 99% go to indictment. Mm-hmm. That's how we work. There, we don't have, so, I shouldn't say, it's literally in my career, probably 95% went to indictment. Very few preliminary hearings. But nevertheless, I want to talk really quick about this probation, because I did look this up, okay? So this is all he got. And I understand why now, and I guess my ire should also go toward the prosecutor, because the prosecutor only charged this cruelty to a child. They didn't charge anything worse than that, despite the particularly heinous and disgusting injuries. Mm-hmm. All he got was fines and fees, zero. County jail sentence, 180 days, but what he ended up doing was, instead of being in county jail, he got on some sort of work release, you know, community service. He was sentenced to 72 months.
Okay.
Suspended. So only 6 years for doing that to a child.
That's correct.
And then
that's only if he violates.
And 48 months of probation.
Right. So
in other words, 2023.
Right. So that means he has 4 years to mind his P's and Q's. And if during that 4 year period, he doesn't violate any of the terms of probation, he stands convicted. Don't get me wrong. You know, he'll be a branded felon for life, but he will not be going to prison. But because probation got revoked during the probationary period based on this new arrest, he's not getting out. At a minimum, he's going to get those 6 years, the 72 months. He will, at a minimum.
Years. And that baby has life in a you know, bedridden.
For two kids, when you really think about it, that could be the penalty for two kids. Because let's say he walks on the murder, and the judge just doesn't want to let him go and really wants to flex and dig in and stick it to the guy, you know? Well, unfortunately, he can only give him 6 years because that's what he pled to in the first case, you know? But it's all right. At least he's not walking. And to be fair, if he's put through the process and a jury disagreed and found reasonable doubt, why should he get more time? He wasn't convicted of the new charge, you know? So I don't think it's necessarily fair to hold acquitted conduct against a probationer. I don't think it's fair. That's me anyway.
Well, you know, we're going to see what happens. None of us have really seen the case. We really haven't. We right. And don't know where the baby is. What I found interesting is
I think we know. Come on. We know. That baby has taken a dirt nap. We know exactly where that baby is.
I'm just saying, well, I know the baby is deceased. Emmanuel is deceased. But my point is, law enforcement was very clear that they had a good idea of where Emmanuel was. Mm-hmm. And I find that very interesting. So they're believing Jake, in my opinion. He must have given enough detail where they're actually believing him. So that Perkins operation was brilliant.
Yes.
Because now he's sort of...
He's kicking himself is what he's doing. Yeah.
He's already committed.
But be honest. I want you to be honest with me. Let's just pretend that during the Perkins operation, he didn't say a word. Said he just talked about the weather, his favorite meal, his favorite music, and didn't say a word about the crime. Is there enough to get him on a murder? I don't think it's there.
Well,
I truly don't. His mouth got him into this.
Well, I agree to a degree because I think we're sort of blinded. We don't know exactly what evidence was found in that house. We don't know about the digital information. We don't know if any cameras caught anything. We don't know what the children have said.
Yeah.
So you and I are hamstrung until that preliminary hearing. I tell you what, I think I will have the preliminary hearing on the show.
Okay.
And hopefully, maybe you and I can work can show the preliminary hearing, which will be 99%, but in between sidebars and things, we can comment about what's going on. I would love to do that with you, Philip. This is actually in your backyard. One more quick question.
Sure.
You talked about capital punishment. We don't have capital punishment in California, do they?
Absolutely. We've got the what we call the needle. You know, the big spritz, lethal injection. We absolutely do. The problem is that Governor Gavin Newsom has entered a moratorium on it while he's in office.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
It's a moratorium, but it is still statutory and the prosecution can still seek it. So if they ever get a pro-death penalty governor in office, they can lift the moratorium and start executing people. Absolutely, they can.
Okay. I guess I meant in practicality, there's a moratorium, but statutorily, it
exists. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Yes.
Good to know, because you threw me for a loop there when you said that. And that makes a lot of sense to me. This case, I really want to stay on. I think it's so important for a lot of reasons, and it's got a lot of interesting maneuvers in terms of the Perkins operation, as well as what's going to happen with Rebecca.
I would love to defend her. I absolutely would. I would do it pro bono. I would take her case pro bono because I truly believe I genuinely mean it, that at most she was an accessory after the fact, at most. I did not hear one shred of evidence that she had a hand in ending the baby's life. Thus far, nothing. That's just my take.
Well, she has the black eye. So we know she was abused.
Yes.
That was a healing black eye. That was nothing to do with what happened on, you know, the date of the 14th that she said it happened on. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting. Let me get one last prediction from you before we go, because I've kept way longer than an hour.
Sure.
You predict that Jake will turn on Rebecca will turn on Jake, or they'll turn on each other.
I think once Rebecca gets solid counsel, meets with prosecutors and explains what happens, maybe even gets a psych report on her to show that she's a victim of battered intimate partner type violence, I think they're going to cut her a deal in exchange for testifying against Jake. And frankly, I think the public can live with that. I think they can see her as a battered spouse. They're not going to condone it. And they're not going to appreciate any mother who kind of cast a willfully blind eye toward the battering of an infant. But as long as she did not have a hand in it and only covered it up under California law, that has a 3-year top at halftime. And I would go to the mat for her like a Bengal tiger.
All right, Bengal tiger.
What an image, huh?
Tiger. Every, you know, I remember the first time I had you on, I had my striped dress.
Oh yeah. What did I say? My mouth. It gets me into trouble, Jennifer. I apologize.
It was hilarious. for those of you who didn't watch that episode, I had the striped dress on. And at some point, yeah, you made such a funny quip. You said you look like the get out of jail free card guy.
Oh, yeah. On the Monopoly board. Yeah, exactly. That was funny.
That was so quippy. It was so great.
Yeah. Listen, you had another one last time. It was like black and yellow. Do you want me to comment? I almost said you look like a bumblebee.
Well, we're beautiful. I'm in black, so you can't. Well, yeah. You know.
No. But I will tell you this. I'm going to put it out that you have a magnificent head of hair. I am not kidding. My God, you give your hairdresser a run for their money. Let me tell you.
You know what's so funny? For those of you who don't know it, Philip, many moons ago, pre-law, it was a hairdresser. So when we first started talking, he let me know. He was like, do you have, what do you call those? Weaves or braids or something? Extensions.
Yes.
I'm like, I don't have any. Why would I get extensions in this hot mess of hair?
Oh, are you kidding? You're blessed with like a lion's mane of hair, you know? Yeah.
Bengal tiger, lion mane. We got it. We're the cat.
Horse tail. It's a horse tail.
It's actually what it feels like. It is not great. That beautiful. You know how people have that sort of fine hair, but they have a lot of it, but it's so silky. Mine is not that. The other day, I did a show at the first of the week, and my hair was out to here. So anyway,
Fun fact, I don't know. I tell you that before law school, I was a hairdresser?
Yes, that's what I was just saying.
I was. Yeah.
I think it's great. You can tell it by the hat, just how you're all put together.
And by the way, I should have stated it. It's much more lucrative. Come on, be honest. What does it cost for you to get that lion's mane done? It's a fortune, right? Ladies, comment. Put it all in the chat. What does it cost to get your hair done? It's a fortune, isn't it?
Now, mine really isn't. I go to this young girl. She's about 22. And she blows it out, gives me a little touch up with the flat iron. And it's, $35.
Oh, that's a bargain. She's a keeper. You got to keep her.
Yeah. I tip her almost what?
Yeah.
A lot because I want her to keep care of me. And oh my gosh, she keeps me there for about 2 hours. She massages.
How could she live on that? How could she afford to even live on it?
Well, her aunt owns the salon. Anyway, we've totally digressed, which is kind of nice to do because I got to tell you, being immersed in this all day long between my expert cases that are murders and these, you know, cases that I look at on Twitter, sometimes it's just nice to decompress a little bit.
Of course.
All of it is so sad.
I know.
And, you know, we know what that baby suffered.
Of course. Oh, I don't even want to talk about it. Terrible.
So let's hope justice prevails here.
Yeah, I say justice is like the IRS, okay? Meaning they're slow, but they eventually get you. That's what justice is, you know? Yes, it's true.
Well, I'm ready for Jay Caro to go away for the rest of his natural life. And if there's any way they have the goods, and maybe it's going to be like with Harmony Montgomery, I don't know how you are with that case, but where the girlfriend, in this case, the wife, has to, you know, testify to get the father put to jail for life. I think I could almost make a deal with the devil, but I don't want her out anytime soon.
Right. Yeah.
All right, my friend. Thank you for being here on your Friday night.
It's been a pleasure. Have a great weekend.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Peace out. Be well.
You guys, thank you so much for being here. Every time, you know, I expected to go about 45 minutes to an hour. Philip's knowledge is so great that, I mean, he brings up such great points. He's such a great legal mind. We are so happy to have him on the show. And we're going to follow this. I'm going to definitely feature this in. And if they allow cameras in that hearing, I'm going to try to have it on here for everybody to see. I know many of you will probably want to watch it on Court TV or Long Crime or one of the other networks. But if you're a friend of the show, we're going to try to have it here. I'll try to have Philip on, assuming his schedule permits. And I wanted to say Crime Con is coming up, I think, this weekend and into the week. A lot of people have asked me, are you going? Are you going? What's going on? I wanted to let everybody know I am not going this year. I actually was honored to be asked to teach both firearms and self-defense. It's a this particular group that asked me is a nonprofit that helps with women who have been sexually assaulted, men and women who have been sexually assaulted, domestic violence victims. The class size is nice and small. I'm going to have 20 ladies. I think it's all ladies in this class. And it's in Montana. I am so excited. I'm going to take pictures. I'll talk about it next week after I get back. So it will probably be that following week. But maybe I'll do something from Montana on the show because I think it's so important to teach, to help, to, you know, try to help women do what they can so that they are not, they have some offense when they're in a situation where they're being assaulted. So I'm really looking forward to that. I thank you all for being here tonight. So appreciate each and every one of you. Thank you to my mods who came on last minute too. And mostly thank you to Philip DeBay. And to all of you in the audience, I appreciate you. I know we're a small channel, but if you like what you saw, like and subscribe, maybe become a member. And we've got some merch ideas that I'm working on. So anyway, looking forward to trying to grow the channel. And thanks to each of you. Until next time, may justice be served.
Want to break the case with Jennifer Coffendaffer even more? Then press subscribe right now and join Jen on YouTube. Just search Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer now.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.